I don't know how many of you read the talk topic, maybe that Jonathan sent out, but I wanted tonight to talk about greed. And I want to start the talk with a story for you. It's a personal story. About 15 or 20 years ago, the Sangha that I was leading then used to travel to this forest monastery to listen to the monks talk. And one of these times, one of the monks who knew me as the leader of our gatherings kind of slipped me a note. And the note said that he was leaving the monastery. This is a monk that I knew. And he had a few boxes of books, and he asked if my husband and I could help him by storing these few boxes of books for him for a few weeks. We later learned that this particular monk had been kicked out of the monastery. We had no idea why he was kicked out of the monastery. We actually never learned. But we kind of felt a little tricked because he hadn't told us this. But at the time, I was really enthralled with monks. So, of course I said yes, I would take his boxes for him. So my husband and I brought our pickup truck to the monastery, and instead of a few boxes of books, he also wasn't honest about another thing, it was more like 20 boxes of books. And we not only filled our truck, but the seats in the truck, it was packed. And it filled our, seemed to fill our entire basement. We have a pretty small house. You know, the monk told us that he was moving to this monastery in New York, and that the monastery wouldn't allow him to have that many books at one time. It was a lot of boxes, I can understand. So we would have to send him these books one at a time on our dime. So every few weeks, he would send me a note saying, I'd like this particular book from this particular, and I would have to go down to the basement and search through 20 boxes of books to find these books for him, and then send them, and drive out, send them. And then 2 weeks later, we finished reading the books, so we'd need more books. Can you send me this particular book? This went on for 6 months. And I want to tell you that while there were many books on Buddhist teachings, which I read, I really, it was like a little library, my own personal library down there, the vast majority of it was actually sci-fi books. And as I'm sure most of you know, basements in Virginia are not great places to store cardboard boxes of books. And so I was a little exhausted with all of this, and I felt really taken advantage of and kind of lied to. And so about 6 months in, we ended up spending quite a bit of money and sent the rest of the boxes, all the boxes back to the monastery. And of course, we never heard from him again. This has remained a lesson for me on so many levels. And one of these is that the reality of how hard it is for all of us to let go of desire or attachment. If this ordained Buddhist monk who had spent a couple of decades given his life to the practice could not let go of his books, how hard is it for the rest of us to let go of our stuff? Anybody have heart palpitations when you think about letting go of your books? Anybody? I know I do a little bit. I'm attached. So the Buddha taught, of course, that there are three root causes of all our suffering, right? There's greed, wanting, desire, attachment. There's aversion, which is not wanting, ill will, hatred. And then there's delusion, which is not understanding basically that those two things, those first two things, are causing us our suffering. In the Majjhima Nikaya, the Buddha says, most people fail to see reality because of wanting. I'll read that again. Most people fail to see reality because of wanting. They are attached. They cling to material objects, to pleasures, to the things of this world. This very clinging is the source of suffering. That's a pretty profound statement, right? So greed, aversion, and delusion are often called the three poisons. And what I always like to try to remember about that is that the main ingredient of all of these poisons is a sense of a separate self. That's the main ingredient in all of these. And of course, whenever we create a sense of a separate self, we inevitably need to create a sense of other, which then prompts a need to protect, prop up, defend this sense of self. I, me, mine. And as the teachings show, all of this selfing or selfishness really is the root of all our suffering when we make everything personal, all about me. Right? With the poison of greed, there might, for instance, be a sense of, I want more than that person or those people, right? We tend to do this either because there's a sense of, I feel better than, more important, more deserving than, or maybe I'm fearful of scarcity, that I won't get the amount I need or that I feel I deserve. With greed, there can also be a sense of never enough, never enough. So, you know, if this is pleasant, if I have even more, I'll be even happier. If I have one more piece of pie, one more pair of those really cute shoes, you know, one more book, one more mansion, one more golf club, one more high rise, one more country. The problem is, even if we do get that extra piece of pie, shoes, maybe that new country, it still doesn't feel like enough to fill that empty space that needs filling. Inevitably, that place within starts to feel empty again, always, and then we feel like we need even more to fill it. And if you think about it, this tendency of ours is really what marketers thrive on. They know our human tendency very, very well. So much so that greed, I think, is so often worshipped in this country. We seem to admire people simply for how much money they've managed to amass rather than the quality of their hearts or their good deeds. Check that out, right? According to the teachings, though, these people are actually suffering too because they're delusional in a way. They're drunk on that poison of greed. They're addicted to the poison of greed. And they're suffering. It's like that old saying, some people are so poor, all they have is money. Some people are so poor, all they have is money. In Buddhist cosmology, as many of you may know, especially in the Tibetan tradition, which I started out in, greed is often represented in the form of the pretas, or the hungry ghosts. And the story is that there's these beings who have been reborn into the realm of the hungry ghosts, and they have these tiny, tiny, tiny little pinhole mouths and these gigantic tummies. And because their mouths are so tiny and their hunger is so huge, they can never, ever be satisfied. So they suffer greatly, all while doing really unskillful things in order to fill their great and totally insatiable needs. The teacher and healer, Teyaskai, points to the way we ourselves can take on the metaphoric shape of these hungry ghosts. She writes, everything has a vibration. When you embody the energy of wanting, the vehicle of your being takes a particular shape, the shape of wanting. And in the shape of wanting, nothing can be truly received. Love cannot fit into this shape. Prosperity cannot fit into this shape. Peace cannot fit into this shape. In our own practice, then, it's super important to really investigate our minds so that more and more we can begin to recognize the arising of the poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion and see more clearly how they're blocking us from those things that we truly want, right? Which is things like peace and compassion, kindness, you know, true prosperity. So whenever we sit down on the cushion, we're in essence agreeing to make a great effort with ourselves, to be totally honest with ourselves and courageously bring up these things into the light so we can work with them and then ultimately hopefully transform them. We want to see them. The topic of greed is in fact so huge. I thought I'd explore the topic of dana tonight, which is the practice of generosity and is really the antidote to greed because it's the opposite, okay? Generosity, if you will, is the medicine for the poison of our clinging, our attachment. And of course, this is all really aimed at our deeply rooted attachment to the biggest source of our suffering, which is, again, that sense of a separate self. in the Buddhist tradition, dana or generosity is the very first, it's the first one, and I know Jonathan's talked about this in his series, it's the first of what are called the 10 perfection or the paramis. These are the 10 qualities that the Buddha urged us to consciously cultivate that can help liberate us from our stress and suffering and foster more joy and happiness in our lives. So if you want more joy and happiness in your lives, cultivate these things. These 10 are dana, generosity, starts with generosity, ethics or virtue, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, and equanimity. The basis for cultivating these qualities can be summed up a bit, I think, in this quote from Tenasaro Bhikkhu, who says, if you make things like material wealth, status, or relationships your priorities, then you're placing your happiness on things that are largely out of your control. Whereas the qualities you develop in your mind as you go through life are in your control. They are the things you can determine that you'll develop in any situation regardless. It's also like the title of one of Jon Kabat-Zinn's books, which I love. It's, you don't have to read the whole book. It's just the title of it. Wherever you go, there you are. Isn't that great? It's so true. Really, it's not all the things that you have or where you live or what title you have in life. You can't take it with you. No. And it's the qualities of mind and especially of our heart that is going to determine our happiness and unhappiness, no matter what. I want to stop here for a moment and just reemphasize that, you know, the Buddha also taught that not all desire is bad. Not all desire is bad. Some people think that with Buddhist practice. Now, I'm not supposed to want anything. And that's not accurate. Okay? Of course we want things. We want material things, those cute shoes. Spiritual things. We want for our lives and the lives of others to be better. It's totally natural and it's okay. The Buddha actually tells us there's healthy desire, which is arises out of care, appreciation, loving kindness. We have a healthy desire to want ourselves and others to be happy, and this type of desire is actually encouraged. Okay? What the teachings are saying is that it is our attachment and clinging that is the real cause of our suffering, which is an important distinction. The poet William Blake, I think, described this well when he wrote, "Those who enter the gates of heaven are not beings who have no passions or who have curbed their passions, but those who have cultivated an understanding of them." Okay. So one of the ways we practice with our strong attachment is by practicing the first parami, dana, which is something most of us actually practice here every week in the form of putting something in the dana basket, those of you who are regulars here. And I'm actually really glad to be talking about dana tonight because it's not something that's really generally understood in the West. Most people think of it as simply, you know, the money we offer each week into the donation basket. That's dana. I remember Sharon Salzberg, the teacher, saying that years ago she was struck by a Thai forest master who visited us here in the West, who was really puzzled about the sequence of teachings that we seem to follow here. Sharon said, "In Asia, the teachings proceed from generosity to morality and then to meditation or insight. But here we appear to begin with meditation, then say something about morality, and only after some time, as a kind of appendix, teach about generosity." Isn't that interesting? In the East, they start with generosity. So dana, or the practice of generosity, is actually an incredibly important quality of heart that we are asked to actively cultivate. And through continued practice, this is going to help us to purge or cure the poison of greed or attachment, clinging. This great practice of continually letting go helps us to open our hands, our hearts, our minds, instead of gripping onto everything so tightly. There's a beautiful African proverb that I like to recall when I think of this, which is simply, it is the heart that gives, the fingers just let go. It is the heart that gives, the fingers just let go. In the Buddhist practice, what we begin to understand is that when we are practicing giving, we're not doing it just for others. We're honestly, truly doing it for ourselves as well. It's really important. This is because as we practice more and more, we begin to see that true liberation or freedom from suffering involves not clinging to anything. That's really our whole practice. Not clinging to anything. So hard. The teacher Ajahn Chah has famously summed up this idea in a short, quite famous verse that I love. If you let go a little, you'll have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you will be free. If you let go completely, you will be free. So giving and letting go can actually mean so many things. And so often we tend to, you know, first think of material things like money, but it can also be things like your time. Some people say is money, right? Your time. Your need to be right. It's another thing we could let go of. Your beliefs. Your old harmful habits or behaviors. How we think it should be or turn out. Our tight expectations. Think about how much you cling to that. How it should be. How you should be. How they should be. How it should be. How often during the day, minute by minute, do you have that thought? This might also include whatever might be holding us back, but we're afraid to let go of for whatever reason. Okay? What might be holding you back that you're afraid to let go of? This could be a thing, a job, a relationship, a belief. Check it out. What are you afraid to let go of? It's a good question to ask. And again, it includes letting go of our biggest clinging or attachment, that solid sense of self. This is who I am. Letting go of that. That's the biggest challenge. Traditionally, most people know of dana, again, as donations to the monks or the teachers. And this is because the gift of the Dharma, the noble teachings, is considered among Buddhists to excel all other gifts. In Buddhist Asia, the practice of dana is taught as part of the culture itself, just part of the culture. And it's very common in places like Burma and Thailand for people to offer dana, especially in the form of food for the monks. And they still regularly go out on what are called the alms rounds through the villages with empty bowls. And it's considered an honor for people to give to the monks, mainly because they believe that it creates good merit or karma in this life and the next, and they also want to support their spiritual teachers and help them to continue to train. They also know that by giving, they're cultivating a practice that's going to bring them more joy. So, you know, they're giving because they're thinking, this is going to bring me more merit, and it's going to bring me more joy. Although sometimes I've heard that this can get kind of out of control in the East. So one of my friends, Glenn, many of you may know, he manages retreats for me and a lot of the other teachers at IMCW. He told me during a recent retreat that I was on with him that in places like Thailand, it actually becomes a kind of competition with students trying to outdo other students in their giving so they can show how generous they are and how practiced in letting go. They compete in letting go. And apparently some of them are also giving with the idea that they're going to obtain so much good karma because of their abundant giving, you know, which is kind of funny if you think about it, since that itself is also another form of greed, isn't it? I think. So one of the teachers I sat with recently while on a longer retreat up at IMS in Barre, Massachusetts, told us that many years ago when she was a nun in Burma, not only did people try to give her the most exquisite food they could offer her, But they would sit next to her while she was eating and watch her eat and fan her face with fans, right? And as a Westerner, she said it was so uncomfortable for maybe about a week. Then she got really used to it and liked it. But it was really strange. But for the most part, people honestly give because they are deeply dedicated to the practice of letting go, and they know how beneficial it is for happiness. The teacher Gil Fronsdale said many years ago when he was living in a monastery in Burma, he received a can of tuna that was given to the monks during their alms round. And on the can, it was written, "For international distribution only," which meant that some very poor person had given him their rationing of food. And he said the donation really deeply touched him and deepened his commitment to the practice. He was inspired and motivated by this great act of generosity and wanted to prove himself worthy of this person's donation. And this person gave their only source of food for the day or the week, whatever that was. Another teacher that I recently studied with, Kamala Masters, is a fabulous teacher. She said she once received a donation from a student who said he didn't have any money to offer her, but he was trained as a classical pianist, and he had created a piece of music just for her. And he sent it to her through an email. And she says today that even when she's feeling blue, she plays that piece of music and it just brings her tremendous joy. Such a gift. So you never know what your generosity is going to inspire whenever you offer generosity to whoever it is. You never know. The Buddha described generosity as a way to adorn the mind, to create those beautiful qualities of the mind that support our meditation practice and our life. So the practice of letting go and giving is said to allow the mind to become calm and restful and concentrated and stable, mindful, insightful, and it's going to, apparently, according to the Buddha, better allow the mind to penetrate into the realm of peace. Anybody want that? I know I do, right? So if the mind is really agitated or worried or consumed with greed or hate or fear, the mind is going to be clouded instead of peaceful. Just as a for instance, you might take a moment even right now to consider a time when you didn't give something that you feel regret about. It could even be the tiniest thing that might plague you. Was there ever a time, just consider it, where you didn't give and it still kind of plagues you that you didn't give that thing? Just think about that for a second. This could be a time in your life when you really wanted something to go a particular way and your strong grip or clinging caused you or others to suffer. Could be that as well. As I was writing this talk, I was remembering a few of these in my own life. And one of them includes something so small it just seems super silly, but it literally plagued me for decades. Plagued me. So it was about 20 years ago, an acquaintance from a writer's group I was in drove down to the farmhouse where I live, about an hour and a half away from here. And it was for a small writer's group I was hosting. And she ended up spending the night. We stayed up late and she didn't want to drive home. And she ended up taking up a lot of our time, my husband and I, that night and then the morning. She kind of wouldn't let us go to sleep, and then spent a lot of time in the morning kind of keeping us awake. And when she was finally ready to leave, she asked me if I had some chapstick. Right? Simple thing. And, you know, she said she had a thing about driving with dry lips. So I offered her my favorite honey-flavored Burt's Bees chapstick. And when I went to hand it to her, she says, "Oh no, I don't want to take your Burt's Bees." I said, okay. I pocketed it, and I didn't give it to her. It's ridiculous. It's a piece, little thing of chapstick, right? And as she drove away, I was holding it, just thinking, I can't believe that I'm still holding this chapstick, that I didn't give her the chapstick. It's petty. It's ridiculous. And that plagued me for years. Like, whenever I would use my chapstick, think about it, right? So whenever I have, so I told this story about a month ago to my Sangha, and one gentleman in my Sangha was so sweet. I came up to my bench here, and he had bought me a whole, like, row of 5 different bird's bees. Made me feel better. But, you know, it's just an example that whenever we're suffering in this way, it's really good. It's a great opportunity to really take a good look. What is happening in the mind, body, and heart, right? So just as a for instance, as a way to practice, new people who come on retreat often ask, how much dana? You know, during the dana talk, they say, and some of you may have asked this question or heard it being asked, how much do you give? Right? They feel really anxious about it. They really want to know and pin it down because this really is the American way. You know, there's, it, right? We want to know, give me a price. What is it? One of the practices I offer them is actually something Jonathan taught me. He's so wise. He said, it involves taking a look at your sense of regret. So he said, if you know you're going to drive away feeling happy and light and generous, you've given the right amount. If you think you're going to drive away and feel like you gave too little or even too much, your mind is going to be filled with regret. And you'll often feel this regret in the body, usually right in the tummy or the gut, which if you listen to it, is going to always tell you exactly what you need. But we don't often listen to our hearts or our tummies. They'll tell you what. Your body always is going to give you the right answer. So the practice of dana really involves tapping into your own mind, body, and heart to see what feels right for you. There really, sadly, is no right amount for anything. The amount you give to the teachers, the amount of whatever you're going to offer, whatever you're going to let go of, it's all up to you. In order to be generous, for it to be spiritually healthy, the Buddha teaches that there needs to be a true letting go. If you're still holding on, the giving actually isn't going to be helpful because you're still going to be fostering resentment, anger. It's going to cause you to suffer. The practice of letting go can also help us to become aware of all the ways that we're still holding on and clinging and how this creates suffering. It's a great practice to see where you're stuck. Once we can more clearly see how we're creating suffering, it actually becomes easier and easier to let go because we can clearly see how much suffering it's causing ourselves or others. It just becomes easier because we don't want to have that suffering. And the more we let go, the more space we're going to have in our minds and the more peace and ease we're going to feel. When our mind is holding on to something, clinging, even if this is the way things are supposed to be, anybody have that in politics right now? Anybody? The way it's supposed to be, and clinging to that, shouldn't be this way. When we're clinging to this, holding on to it, we're living with a mind that is cluttered and claustrophobic and blocked off. There is no space for peace. There is no space for peace. As I was packing for one of my retreats that I led this summer, going through what seems like a gigantic pile of shoes in the bottom of my closet, I started thinking what it would be like to live like a nun and just really live with just the essentials, not have to do my hair, you know, not have to have 10, 20 pairs of shoes, nothing but the essentials. And right then it really did feel like freedom, right? Just to let go of all of my stuff. And it's been said that our stuff really owns us. We don't own it. It's really true. Again, the Buddha taught that generosity or letting go is the first parame. And the reason for this is he said it is considered the easiest to do. It's the easiest to do. Letting go is the basis. It's the basis for all the other paramis, for the practice itself. So it's something that we can start practicing. And we can start doing it first in the material world, because that's easier than letting go of old opinions or beliefs or ideas. The material word is easier. So you can start by like clearing out your closet or donating things to charity, you know, maybe, you know, letting go of our collection of books. More heart palpitations, right? Or we can offer our time, our skills, money. So it's the easiest place to start. And as we do, we can begin to notice the mind as we are letting go of things. Notice the mind and the heart and body as we're letting go. So for instance, you can start to be aware of what happens when you try to offer something of yourself. You can ask yourself questions like, do I feel afraid? When you're letting go, do I feel afraid? Is someone going to think I want something back when you give, right? Someone going to think I want something back. Can I ask yourself, do I feel resentful? Do I feel resentful? So with Donna, generosity also implies going beyond what is expected. So if you're giving what's expected, you're not going to be feeling very generous, right? If you're just giving what's expected. So for instance, like if you're donating to Goodwill all the things you didn't want in the first place, or sometimes when you're regifting, that's not really a big letting go, is it? I love this example from Gelug Rinpoche, who says, when you are practicing generosity, you should feel a little pinch when you give something away. That pinch is your stinginess protesting. If you give away your old worn-out coat that you wouldn't be caught dead wearing, that is not generosity. There is no pinch. You are doing nothing to overcome your stinginess. You're just cleaning out your closet and calling it something else. Giving away your coat might keep someone warm, but it does not address the problem we face as spiritual practitioners to free ourselves from self-cherishing and self-grasping. In the teachings, the act of generosity, whatever it is also supposed to bring joy, as I said before. Supposed to bring joy. It is said that there should be joy before, during, and after. So if there's no joy in giving, don't do it. Isn't that great to know? If there's no joy in doing it, don't do it. So there's no obligation. You're just working on noticing joy. And then as you do that, it becomes more and more natural to give. What's also helpful for me to remember is that, again, we aren't practicing generosity as a way to become good. We are not practicing generosity as a way to become good, which implies a kind of grudging obligation. We are practicing as a way to cultivate joy. Joy is one of those inner qualities that supports the path to less suffering or liberation. And Buddha again said generosity was the easiest way to practice generating joy. So if there's no joy, again, it's a great opportunity to take a look inside and ask some questions. Maybe there's a reason you don't want to give or to let go of something. Maybe there's a reason. Maybe it's part of your psyche. Maybe there's some fear there. It's good to take a look. Maybe if there's no joy, you weren't supposed to give or let go of that thing. Okay. The Buddha actually encouraged us to have wise discernment about where we offer our generosity. So he said, to give where we have confidence and where it brings the biggest joy. To give where it has confidence and brings the biggest joy. One of my favorite Buddhist nuns, Pema Chodron, often talks about what she calls idiot compassion, if you've ever heard that, idiot compassion. And I think this can also be translated into idiot generosity. And what I mean by this is that some of us tend to give way too much of ourselves. And instead of generosity, this can be a form of not recognizing our own worthiness, maybe a sense of others deserve more than me. Is that bringing joy? It's not. And in this case, it's important to remember what the Buddha taught, which is you can search the entire universe for someone who is more deserving of your love and affection than you are yourself, and that person is not to be found anywhere. You yourself, as much as anybody in the entire universe, deserve your love and affection. So when the Buddha is said to use wise discernment, this means using your good judgment. Using your good judgment, which includes asking yourself, am I giving too much of myself here? Am I giving myself too much? Am I confident that this will bring both me and the other person joy? Since it really does need to be both. You might even ask yourself, am I giving just to please someone? Which might also include the question, am I giving to please myself in some way? All good inquiries to ask. And finally, as a kind of encouragement, the Buddha taught us that when people are generous, other beings love them quite a lot. So the teacher Sharon Salzberg says, such love occurs without a sense of contrivance or expectation. We don't give so we can become popular. Being loved is not part of the motivation for the act of giving. It's just a law of the universe. As we give, we receive. So there is an openness that beings feel towards us and a great deal of love. If you think about somebody you know who's very generous, even if they haven't given to you directly, what does it feel like if you call this person to mind? There is so much warmth and such delight. That is how we regard people who are generous. Okay. So I hope that's some encouragement. When people are generous, other beings love them quite a lot. Okay. So in the time that we have, I'd just like to end with a brief reflection on generosity. So this will just be short. So just coming into a nice posture for a moment. And just breathing in deeply, filling the body. Really letting go on the exhale. A couple of rounds of these just to settle a little bit, clear the mind. Open the mind for inquiry. Our attitudes towards generosity are often conditioned by how generosity was viewed and practiced in our family and in the culture we grew up in. So as a way of bringing these things into your awareness, you might just spend a few minutes considering how you may have been influenced by this particular conditioning, family, culture. You might consider, what are the formative influences that shaped your relationship to generosity? Just consider. You might consider, what beliefs do you have that might interfere with acting on your impulse to be generous? Are there any beliefs that might interfere with acting on your impulse to be generous? You might now consider some ways you could start to overcome any limitations that these beliefs have placed on you, if any. Maybe a way to question the validity of some of these beliefs. You might also consider all the ways that it benefits you to be generous, to let go. And leaning into the felt sense of joy or warmth that might arise from being generous or letting go, and nurturing that sense of letting go. And if it's helpful, you can always place a hand on the heart to get a sense of the joy or warmth that might arise from letting go of clinging. What could you let go of that would bring joy, more joy? And finally, with the eyes still closed, just listening to these words from Nancy Paddock, who writes, "Lie down with your belly to the ground like an old dog in the sun. Smell the greenness of the clover leaf. Feel the damp earth through your clothes. Let an ant wander the uncharted territory of your skin. Lie down with your belly to the ground. Melt into the earth's contours like a harmless snake. All else is mere bravado. Let your mind resolve itself in a tangle of grass. Lie down with your belly to the ground, flat out on ground level. Prostrate yourself before the soil you will someday enter. Stop doing. Stop judging, fearing, trying. This is not dying, but the way to live in a world of change and gravity. Let go. Let go. Let your burdens drop. Let your grief charge bleed off into the ground. Lie down with your belly to the ground and then rise up with the earth still in you."